And this is All In. I'm Taylor Bennett. Today we're getting an update on what happened in the first half of the Indiana legislative session and also a preview of what might be coming next. If you have any questions or comments on our show today, you can let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail. Call us at 866-476-3881. All you have to do is just give your name, where you're calling from, and a quick question or comment, and we'll do our best to get it into the conversation. Again, that number is 866-476-3881. And you can also send us high-quality voice messages with our smartphone app. It's called All In Vox Pop. It's free, easy to use. All you need to do is search for All In Vox Pop on your phone's app store. We're joined now by two guests today, Brandon Smith, a State House reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting. Hi, Brandon.
Hey there, Taylor.
And Nikki Kelly is a government and politics reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. Welcome, Nikki.
Welcome. Thanks for having me, Taylor.
Absolutely. Thank you both so much for taking time. I know you both have been very busy. We have a lot to talk about today. And Brandon, before we get into any specific pieces of legislation, what are lawmakers doing right now? I mean, obviously, you know, things have been a little different up until this point for the session. Things have been operating a little bit differently since we're in the middle of a pandemic. So what has it been like covering the State House so far?
Yeah, there's been parts of it that have been really weird and really, really different. The physical, like, way that the session is happening has been changed. For instance, the Indiana House of Representatives is not meeting in the Indiana House of Representatives chamber this year in full session. They moved their chamber to just across the street, if you will, to Government Center South, which has a series of conference rooms that they've turned into the chamber, which allowed for a little more social distancing than was possible in the House chamber, obviously during COVID. Testifying in committees has been different. In a lot of committees, the people who are testifying have been separate, in a separate room from lawmakers, connected via video streams. Reporters haven't been able to sort of gather in committee hearings the way they have in the past. It's at most one reporter could be in there, and most of us are just doing it virtually like any other member of the public who wants to watch. So there's been things like that that have been different. But one thing that we've noted on here at the session's halfway point has been the pleasant surprise that there was no shutdown or suspension of the session because of a COVID outbreak. Lawmakers certainly had anticipated that might happen. A lot of us who are around the legislature thought that was going to be a real possibility, even a likely thing, and it didn't end up happening, which is a credit to, I think, a lot of the lawmakers, but even more so the staff behind the scenes who not only helped set up all of these protocols, but obviously have been doing a good job keeping themselves and the lawmakers safe. So there have been some people who have been out with COVID that we know of, but we haven't seen any sort of stoppage, and that's a really positive development.
You know, obviously, you know, the social distancing has probably helped with that. What about the mask wearing? How's that been handled at the State House? Everyone complying with that?
No. They are not. We had a couple of flare-ups during session of groups of people coming to the State House specifically to testify and sort of rally around a bill that ended up dying in maybe in part because of the flare-up caused by their refusal to wear masks. But it would have said that employers can't mandate people get the COVID-19 vaccine or any vaccine if they have a certain a conscientious objection to it, which would be an expansion of current federal and state law. So we saw groups of people come into the State House, refuse to wear masks. Other people who wanted to testify refused to do so because they were worried about their safety. Legislative leaders said they would crack down on that. They didn't really, but we didn't really see that pop up again, fortunately, in session. Lawmakers themselves have not been very diligent about wearing masks. That has eroded over the course of the session so far. Early on, it was, I'm thinking more in the House, there was like maybe two lawmakers, three, who weren't wearing masks. Now it's at least a third of the chamber, if not more. But again, fortunately, they seem to have avoided any serious outbreaks. So I guess that's good.
Well, as far as compliance, though, I mean, obviously, if some of them aren't wearing masks and others are, do they ever get into any conversations like, or do they feel pressured? Obviously, they don't feel pressured if they're not wearing their mask still at this point, halfway point.
I don't think there's been much of that. I think we all kind of, once the legislative leaders decided not to actually enforce mask wearing in any way, shape, or form, I think a lot of us expected exactly what's happened.
Yeah. Any other surprising or significant things that have happened or had an impact on the session that maybe surprised you?
No, in terms of how the session is run, certainly that's been the big surprise, is that that they've been able to get through the first half of session without any COVID slowdowns or stoppages.
All right. Nikki, what about you? What's it been like covering the session for you? I know you've been covering the sessions for a long time, too.
Yeah, I mean, I think Brandon's right. It's been a little more difficult to track down lawmakers, to ask them about their bills, things like that. A little more difficult, if you're in one room, to go see who just testified. Maybe even on another floor, it's hard to go get their name and things like that. But as far as surprises, other than that, I would say obviously the issue that happened last week on the House floor and some racial tensions was definitely something I have not seen in my 20 plus years. Obviously, people get annoyed at each other sometimes and get heated, but that one was a bit more than anything I've seen before.
Yeah, we'll talk about that, what happened last week. And I want to talk first a little bit about the state budget. It is a budget year, and it's a lot of things going through the state house right now. What does that look like, Brandon? Anything surprising with the budget that you've come across so far?
The budget process works that the governor puts out their proposed budget first early in January. Then the House Republicans unveil their budget, usually in February, pass it out, and then the Senate Republicans will get probably in March or potentially early April. There are always differences, certainly, between those budget proposals. But I would say that there was a more stark difference this year than I've seen in a little while between the governor's and the House Republican budget. And specifically, I'm thinking about how both of those proposals would spend significant reserve dollars, budget reserve dollars that the state is going to have at the end of this fiscal year. So, like every other state, Indiana thought it was going to be in a really bad situation financially during the pandemic. And initially it was. State revenues took a plunge because, the economy was largely shuttered for at least a month or two. But in Indiana, at least, things have really recovered when we look at state finances. And so lawmakers are looking at state budget reserves that are going to be at the same level that they were before the pandemic by the end of this June, which is, I think, a shock to a lot of folks. If you asked about a surprise, that would be a surprise to many of us.
And how do you think? I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, well, so what they're doing is, instead of having huge budget increases in the actual 2-year state budget, what they're instead proposing is, well, let's take some of these big budget reserve dollars we have and focus on one-time things we can spend it on. The governor wanted to pay down debt. He spent $700 million in his proposal to pay down capital projects, highway projects, and the teacher pension fund, which frees up money for the state general fund. House Republicans did almost none of that. They did some of the capital projects the capital projects the governor wanted, none of the highway projects, none of the teacher pension funds. Instead, they're focused on things that have cropped up over the last year. They're spending a bunch of money, $150 million, on small business recovery grants. They're spending money on learning loss. So students have struggled, obviously, during the pandemic, to help students recover from learning loss during the pandemic. They're spending money on law enforcement facilities and training and body cameras. So that was a really stark difference, I think, between the governor's budget and the House Republican budget. I'm guessing that the Senate Republicans will do something pretty similar to what the House Republicans have done. We'll see what differences they find there. But yeah, there was a pretty stark difference this year that I don't think we often see between the two budget proposals.
And it seems like a lot of that money that they want to spend kind of relates to what's happened in the past year.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's what House Republicans really focused on is the governor's budget almost, like, if you didn't know that COVID was a thing, you wouldn't have known it from Governor Holcomb's budget proposal. It looked like any other year's budget. And I think House Republicans sort of identified that and said, no, there are things that we can spend that money on right now to help people.
Mm-hmm. Where does it stand right now? What's the next step as far as budget spending?
Next step will be the Senate Republicans. They'll have the budget. They don't do that right at the start of the second half. They take their time to sort of craft their proposals with Senator Ryan Mishler, the budget architect, and other members of his caucus and their staff. So again, we'll see that either late in March or maybe very early April. But we'll get their proposal that'll pass out of the Senate, and then the House and the Senate, and theoretically the governor will craft a final version in the final days of session.
All right. They're not in session this week anymore, right?
Nope.
And they'll come back.
They wrapped things up Tuesday in the House and yesterday in the Senate.
All right. And then they come back Monday?
Monday. Yep.
All right. And then what kind of time frame are we looking at to get things done?
Statutorily, it's April 29th. And they could always change that if they needed to. And they talked at the beginning of session, because of all the unknowns with COVID, that was flexible if it needed to be. But, you know, with no slowdowns and stoppages, I think we're on track for wrapping up by the end of April.
So no talk of special session.
There is going to be a talk of special session, but
does that have to do with redistricting when they have to come back?
Yeah, that's exactly right.
That's going to be a big one when they have to come back, when they get all that data. That's for sure.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
All right. Well, we're going to come back. Nikki, I want to talk to you when we come back after our break about maybe some COVID-related pieces of legislation that might still be moving over there at the General Assembly and find out more some of the things that is going on with lawmakers and what we have to look forward to. We will be right back with our guest after just a quick break, and we'll get an update on the first half of the legislative session right here in Indiana. Of course, if you have questions or comments for the show today, you can let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. And you can also leave us a voicemail, 866-476-3881, 866-476-3881. I'm Taylor Bennett. We'll be right back. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Taylor Bennett. We're talking today about the legislative session happening at the Indiana State House. We'd love your questions and comments on this topic. You can find us on Facebook and also Twitter at All In Indiana, or you can leave us a voicemail, including your first name and where you're calling from. That number is 866-476-3881. You can also send us a voice message through our free smartphone app. It's called All In Vox Pop. You just search for All In Vox Pop on your phone's app store, send us your question or comment, and we will try to get it onto the show today. We're joined by two guests. Brandon Smith is the State House reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting, and Nikki Kelly, a government and politics reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. Welcome back. All right, Nikki, I wanted to talk to you about any COVID-related pieces of legislation that might still be moving over there at the State House right now.
Well, there's a couple that are big. One has already been signed into law by the governor. They moved it very fast, and that would provide basically shield businesses or nonprofits or schools from liability in COVID lawsuits. So, like, you couldn't go to the grocery store and say you got COVID there and then try to sue someone. There are some debates about whether it's even needed. We haven't seen any of those lawsuits in the last year, but Republican leaders seem to think that we need that protection to fully get back to going. There are some concerns about whether it goes too far. If there's negligence or misconduct, you could still sue with those things. But I think one of the more interesting issues is this whole idea of looking at the governor's powers. The legislature gave him these powers to use during disasters, which we have during the pandemic, and he has use them for going into year two now. He's just continually renewed his disaster declaration. And within those, he has abilities to waive laws, institute things like face covering mandates. He shut down schools. He shut down businesses earlier on. And so the lawmakers want to make sure that if this would ever happen again in the future, that they have more of a say, because it just so happened timing-wise that they went out of session right as COVID hit last year, and they didn't come back till January. So while they do legally have the right to cancel or terminate one of these declarations, they couldn't, they weren't in session to do so. And the only person who can call them in is the governor. Mm-hmm. So they're looking at a couple bills in both the House and Senate that would limit how long the governor could do one of these declarations before the legislature would have to get involved and approve it. The Senate bill especially is pretty, I would say, a little stronger in that it basically says after 60 days, the governor can't do this for a widespread emergency. And then the legislature would be the only one who would be able to continue that.
Why do some of the lawmakers feel that the governor doesn't need to have that authority?
Well, I mean, I think they just heard a lot from their constituents who were upset at some of the moves being made from the governor. And I think as a co-equal branch of government, they felt like they should have more of a say. Obviously, I think everyone realized when this law was put in place years and years, decades ago, and then it was tweaked a little after September 11th. You know, I don't think anyone truly envisioned a year-long emergency. It was more people thinking about like tornadoes or floods or, I don't know, a utility failure like we saw down in Texas, something like that. But so I do think it's fair to, you know, revisit the idea now that we've seen how it can work in action. But, you know, it's all about finding a balance between, you know, taking power away from the governor and giving legislators a way to weigh in.
Mm-hmm. And as far as that is concerned, where does that stand at the State House right now?
Well, we have two different bills, one passed the House, one passed the Senate. So now they'll go to each other's chamber and we'll try to see which one they like better as we go through this. The governor has been concerned about the constitutionality, I think especially probably more of the House bill, because it would have allowed the legislature to call themselves back into session, which the Constitution doesn't provide for. It also doesn't say they can't. It's just silent on that. But it does say the governor can call them in. So it seems like the Senate moved away from that a little. The Senate basically did kind of a carrot stick approach. They said, you know, you can go this long if you don't call us back in. But if you do call us back in, you can go this long. Regardless, 60 days the limit in the Senate before the legislature would have to maybe extend it.
Okay. Brandon, this has been a topic I think that has been at the State House for a long time, and that is a cigarette tax hike. It's been talked about for many years. What is going on with that right now?
Yeah, I think a lot of advocates for a cigarette tax hike saw the pandemic as an opportunity to really capitalize in the sense that Indiana struggled during COVID-19 because of existing health issues that Hoosiers have. We are near the bottom of the country in a lot of health measures. Beyond public health spending, we have high obesity rates. We have very high smoking rates. And when you're talking about a disease, a virus in COVID-19 that goes after people with those exact comorbidities, that creates an even more serious problem than other states have faced. So I think there was more advocates saw more momentum this time. There was a $1 per pack increase, which would basically double the current cigarette tax that passed fairly easily through the House Public Health Committee. And then the House Republican budget proposal incorporated that cigarette tax hike into it, and it only raised it 50 cents. And that left a lot of advocates really feeling kind of like, what's the point? Mm-hmm. Because the reason to raise the tax is not to get more money. It has that benefit for a little while, hopefully. But really, it's about changing behavior. It's about helping people quit smoking and getting people to stop smoking in the first place. And there is data from other states for years that shows that the price point at which that sort of starts to happen is a dollar per pack increase. So I think a lot of people are going, well, 50 cents, what's the point? You're not going to raise that much money for yourself. You're also really not going to change that much behavior. And that's exactly, interestingly, what Senate President Pro Tem Roderick Bray said when we just talked to him yesterday to sort of wrap up, or 2 days ago, to wrap up the session's first half, which was the Senate Republican caucus has always been far more opposed to any cigarette tax increase than the House Republican budget or House Republican caucus. But asked about that cigarette tax hike, he said, I don't really get the point of 50 cents. So I think when we see the Senate Republican budget, I think it's going to be either at least a dollar increase or no increase at all. I'm personally betting on no increase at all. But I think that was an interesting wrinkle to what everybody thought was finally the session for a big increase in the cigarette tax.
Do you think it has more of a chance of getting through now, since it's kind of got the label of this is a public health thing right now?
It helps. It definitely helps the conversation. But there are some Republicans who are simply opposed to tax increases across the board. There are also others who feel like the government shouldn't be dictating behavior with its policies. And that's exactly what even the public health advocates are saying about a cigarette tax increase. And so it's always going to face those hurdles. I definitely think it had more momentum this time than ever before. But again, long way to go, still 2 months, and we'll see what happens.
That's right. All right. Nikki, let's talk about some bills this session that have specifically things to do with what would take control away from local governments, and then they give it to the state. What are some examples of legislation that is over there that you've reported on?
Well, I mean, we've seen a lot of bills this year that would preempt local governments from doing certain things, whether it's creating their own residential building design limitations or having to do with siting, 5G towers. We've seen efforts that this one failed, by the way, but that would limit them from reducing their police budgets, aka defunding police. There are so many of them moving this year, and many of them seem targeted at Marion County or Indianapolis, but in the impact, but they have statewide impact. You know, we overrided the House and Senate, overrided a veto of a landlord-tenant law from last year that took away the rights of local government units to basically regulate most of any involvement with landlord-tenant rules. Deposits or, you know, retaliation or anything. And so, you know, now local units that started because they didn't like an ordinance that Marion County passed, but it has the impact of preempting all local government from doing the same. So mm-hmm. That's what we're seeing in a lot of situations.
Is that surprising?
I mean, the whole yin and yang of local control has always been there. I do think there are a lot more this year. We had bills saying you can't. We have bills saying if a prosecutor refuses to, you know, go after a crime, they can get the attorney general can get involved. Some of these are like things that they say are happening elsewhere in the nation, and we want to make sure they don't happen here. So I definitely think it's more than usual.
Something I thought in trying to figure out why there's more of those than usual this year is I think lawmakers, and it's the same thing with the governor's emergency powers legislation. I think the legislature and a lot of lawmakers spent the last year or so amid COVID-19 really struggling with feeling powerless in their roles. You know, they weren't in session, but you had all of these things that they disagreed with, whether it was the governor's actions or local government's actions. And I think they came into this session like, you know what? We're tired of feeling like that. We're going to beef up our powers so that we can reassert some of our control here. That's my opinion. I don't know what's in each person's, you know, mind, obviously. But I do think that's at play here, whether it's with the governor's powers or local government's authority in a lot of different areas. I know lawmakers had constituents just screaming at them over the last year. Whether to do something or because constituents often don't understand the powers of different elected officials. But I think that's at play here, too. I think that's why we've seen a notable increase in those sorts of things this year, is because they just felt powerless during the pandemic and they want to sort of reassert some of that control.
I always like to kind of get a feel, since you guys are over there day in and day out and you see this, what do you think is going to happen with that? Anything going to come out of it? Anything pass?
On the local control issues, I think some bills will and some bills won't. We're already seeing some fall by the wayside as they get debated more. So I think a few will probably get through.
All right. Brandon, this Monday, the House approved a bill that does a couple of things around abortion in Indiana. I know you've reported on this. What specifically would that bill do?
Yeah, there's a couple of it deals with, say, four or five parts of abortion regulation, but there's two big ones, two big additions to the abortion regulation process. One has to do with the parental consent form that Hoosiers under the age of 18 have to get signed before they can have an abortion. It would now require that form to be notarized. The proponents of that say, well, they want to make sure that the parents who are giving permission are actually the parents. And Republican Representative Peggy Mayfield, who's the author of the bill, said she knows of two or three situations where someone tried to claim they weren't the parent, you know, tried to claim that they were the parent when they weren't. Of course, we know about those because the systems in place caught that before the abortion actually could happen. Whereas opponents say, well, first of all, you're now having to expose this very private information to a random third party, which doesn't without any real benefit. But the perhaps bigger portion of that bill, provision in that bill, has to do with what's called abortion reversal. So this has been pushed for a little while now. We've seen it across the country. We've seen it even here in Indiana a couple years ago before it was abandoned, temporarily, obviously, because it's come back. But it's this claim from some anti-abortion advocates that a medication-induced abortion can be reversed halfway through the process. So a medication-induced abortion involves two pills, one you usually take at the clinic where it's dispensed, and then the second that you take at home to complete the abortion. And the abortion reversal advocates claim that if you don't take the second pill and instead take something else that can be dispensed, you can stop the abortion from happening. There is limited data to suggest that that might be the case, but every major medical organization, including the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, says there is no good data on that. In fact, there was a valid scientific study that was started in 2019 to really finally look at whether or not abortion reversal was really what advocates said it was. And they had to halt that study because too many women were going to the hospital with serious complications. And that's what opponents of this legislation and this whole debate really point to, which is you're going to require doctors to tell their patients information that the doctors do not believe is true. As one doctor and as a lawmaker on the floor of the House said, you're basically going to require doctors to lie to their patients. We've also seen legislation like that pushed in other states, and so far it's been struck down by courts multiple times. So if this bill does pass, and quite frankly, I kind of expect it to, because generally anti-abortion bills pass the General Assembly in the last decade, I expect we'll see a legal battle, and it's distinctly possible that Indiana will be giving the ACLU more money than it's already been giving over the last 10 years.
Yeah, it's one of those pieces of legislation that always draws out a lot of emotion, too.
Yeah, I mean, I tell people I have a in my computer and you know, with all my stories that I've written over the last 10 years, I have a filing system, and abortion has one for every single year that I've been here.
You probably have a top 10 list of the same things that keep coming up, right? Or maybe
seem
a top five.
Yeah,
or
yeah, seem to rack up a lot of attention.
Yeah. Nikki, before we go to break, I do want to ask you, and we can get more into it when we come back, but another emotional, I think, piece of legislation is a bill that would eliminate Indiana's requirement to get a license to carry a handgun in public. That one is pretty big right now.
That one has been filed a number of years, but they got it out of the House pretty smoothly. It basically eliminates, right now, if you have a gun and you want to carry it in public, you have to get a carry permit. And this would eliminate that altogether. There's the argument from the advocates who say, look, it's a constitutional right. You shouldn't have to go through this process to have to, you know, use your constitutional right. Others point out that, you know, voting is a constitutional right, too, and we make you register and we make you follow a bunch of rules to do it. So that one will be interesting to see in the Senate, because I think the House has discussed it for a number of years, but I've never really seen where the Senate would stand on it, though, frankly, I don't see a problem with it passing.
Yeah. Has there been some really good discussions around it, though?
Yeah, it's been interesting because the policing community is very split on it. Many organizations against it. A few organizations are neutral. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you'll have a cop get up and say it puts them in danger because they won't know when they pull someone over if they are licensed to carry a gun. You have another cop saying it doesn't matter if they're licensed. We want to know about the people who shouldn't have it rather than who do.
Right. All right. Well, we'll talk more. Everything's State House. We'll be right back after this quick break. We're talking with two state government reporters about the ongoing legislative session. I'm Taylor Bennett. We'll be right back. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Taylor Bennett. Back now to our discussion on the legislative session in Indiana. As always, we'd love to hear your questions and comments. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or you can leave us a short voicemail with your first name and where you're calling from. That number is 866-476-3881. Today, we're joined by two guests, Brandon Smith, a State House reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting, and Nikki Kelly, is a government and politics reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal Gazette. Before we went to our break, we were talking about a bill that would eliminate Indiana's requirement to get a license to carry a handgun in public. And Brandon, I wanted to ask you, you reported on the gun license bill a couple of weeks ago, and it said that Indiana law enforcement groups are on both sides of a debate. What's behind that split?
Yeah, Nick, you talked a little bit about this mm-hmm. before the break, which is the Indiana State Police has always been opposed to this because fundamentally, they view it as if you're a frontline police officer, there is only one system currently where if you pull somebody over, you can look up to see whether or not they are licensed to carry a gun. So if you walk up to the car and you see a handgun, but that person has a license, you'd know at least they were authorized to carry that. Similarly, the chiefs of police, the sheriffs, or no, not the sheriff's association, they're neutral on the bill. The chiefs of police and a couple of individual sheriffs did get up and say the same thing as State Police Superintendent Doug Carter. But then you have other groups, more like individual police officers than organizations, who testified, well, I just assume everybody's always a threat, which is probably right for their profession, but also raises questions about the profession. But in any case, what lawmakers have tried to do to sort of bridge that gap then is say, okay, well, we're going to get rid of the licensing system, but we want you, the state police and the state in general, to develop a system whereby a frontline police officer in their car could look up a list of people who aren't allowed to carry a handgun. The problem with that is that there are federal and state privacy laws that say you aren't allowed to look at that information if you're, you know, just a frontline police officer sitting in your car. Like, the background checks that the state police do are very tightly controlled and regulated. And so, you know, they've directed them to develop this system. The state police remains opposed. It's not really clear whether such a system is even possible, but lawmakers don't really care whether or not it's created. They want to eliminate the license, and they're hoping that this will be a bone for that they can throw to law enforcement, but I don't think law enforcement's going to grab it.
Yeah, that'll be interesting to see what happens out of that. All right, well, a group of school choice bills are, I think, has been prompting a lot of emotional debate about school funding at the State House. Nikki, what does some of that legislation look like?
Yeah, I mean, there's really two things. One is just an effort to expand the current voucher program we have. It would increase eligibility to easily higher middle income families. It would also increase the awards that those groups get. There's a second bill that would establish what they call education savings accounts, in which, and it's currently geared only towards special education and military families, but the concern is that eventually this would just be available to everyone. And it would basically involve me. If I was a parent, I would say, I have this child who has an IEP, and you, the state will give you all the funding, or 90% of the funding that your child would otherwise receive the benefit of at a local school district, and they'll put it into an account, and then you're in charge of educating your child. You know, they wouldn't go to public school. You would have to find teachers or maybe enroll them in a private school, that kind of thing. And the problem with all of this is it's also happening as we're discussing the budget. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Republicans are saying, look, we're giving all this new money for K-12. But if you look into those numbers, you know, like 38% of it would be for private school education or these savings accounts. So they're spending a large portion of this new money on private schools or private school education and not public schools, which, you know, educate 95% of our kids.
Well, what are people saying? What are individuals and groups who are testifying in support? What are they saying?
Well, I mean, the groups in support are obviously school choice groups or parents who have taken advantage of it. The groups against are teachers unions. Three former superintendents of public instruction came out against it. They've been very loud about it. And Republicans just say again and again, we're funding students, not systems or schools, which I found funny. Fort Wayne Community Schools board president pointed out that our constitution does not set up a funding for students. It sets up funding for a common school system. So, you know, it's definitely creating the back and forth on that. And interestingly enough, the governor seemed to come out in his State of the State address saying that he supports school choice, but not at the detriment of public schools. And both his budget and the House Republican budget at first blush provided $378 million in new funding for K-12. But his budget had no new voucher dollars. So once you take those out, the House Republican budget gives far less money to traditional public schools.
What are your thoughts on any of those school choice bills passing?
Well, I mean, they seem to have the support. I do think they're going to have to find some additional money for K-12 public schools, because right now the graphics they can make and things like that don't look good. I mean, when you say here's a pot of new money, but 38% of it is for 5% of the kids in the state, you know, that's a tough sell.
I wanted to also talk to you, Brandon, and Nikki, because I know you both were there, about an incident that happened last week where lawmakers reportedly had to be physically separated from each other. What was all that about?
I'm gonna kick off the beginning of this to Nikki, because I wasn't in the room initially. She was, so I know she can kind of describe the scene a little bit better than I can.
Okay.
Yeah, so they were discussing a bill on allowing a township to disannex from a school corporation in South Bend. If you look at the demographics of that situation, it's basically a largely white township moving away from a largely urban or minority-based school district. So several Black representatives came to the microphone and expressed concerns about racism and discrimination. There were several House Republican members who yelled or said no or stop or booed, which led to, you know, some people going out in the hallway off the chamber and having further confrontation where definitely curse words and derogatory terms were hurled. They did have to be separated. Eventually, one member had to kind of be pushed into a bathroom to stop another member from, you know, coming after them. So there's a lot of talk about whether, you know, A, you know, were House Republicans showing the proper respect and decorum? You know, it's one thing if you disagree, you can get up, you can have your say at the microphone. And that's what Speaker Todd Huson was trying to say. You know, you still have to sit there and you have to be respectful and civil. And then there's a whole nother topic behind the sort of physical confrontations that happened outside the chamber. And the Indiana Black Legislative Caucus is pushing for some implicit bias training. Speaker Huson keeps saying he'll discuss it, but he certainly hasn't latched on to that. And honestly, several members of his caucus are adamantly opposed to that and keep posting memes about racism and things like that.
How do you think that's going to impact the session if they don't go through that bias training or those concerns of the Black Legislative Caucus are addressed?
Well, we came back this week and things were a lot more even tempered, a lot more quiet in the chamber. So I think some decorum was reinstituted. I don't think even if they agreed to that training, it would happen this session. I think it's just too compressed of a time frame. So I think they're trying to just get through and they're trying to say, you know, reach out to members opposite the party, get to know their life, their experiences, and we can all learn from each other. But they're trying not to be heavy-handed about it.
All right. Now, Brandon, there's a criminal justice reform bill I wanted to touch on before we have to go today. That's got some bipartisan support. What's that one about?
Yeah, the irony of this one. The felt like the session was headed in a really good direction on a really thorny racial issue, and then things fell apart here right before halftime. But House Bill 1006, which is authored by Republican Representative Greg Stuart-Wald from Avon, is the major achievement, in my opinion, of the session's first half, and might end up being the major achievement of 2021. This is obviously in the wake of the criminal justice and police reform conversations that started last summer with the death of George Floyd, the killing of Breonna Taylor and others here in Indianapolis too, and the Black Lives Matter marches that we saw around Indiana, around the state, around the country, spurred this conversation, led behind the scenes by Representative Stuart-Wald, on what can we do as the Indiana General Assembly to address some of the issues raised by Black and brown communities, but still have those supportive police. And what they put together was a package that does a number of things. It largely bans chokeholds by police in the state of Indiana unless they're authorized to use deadly force. It changes some training. It mandates some de-escalation training for all police in the state of Indiana. It makes it easier for the state police board, a training board, to decertify officers who commit misconduct. And what that means is if you're decertified by that board, you cannot be a cop anywhere in Indiana. And it also really makes it easier. It lowers the definition, if you will, of misconduct. It used to be like you had to commit multiple misdemeanors or, you know, all the way up to a felony. Now it's like one misdemeanor and that's misconduct. You could be cut off from being a cop again or ever again. I had one in my mind and I can't remember the other one.
There's one, just to jump in, that if you as a police officer cover up or block your body camera in order to, you know, hide what you're doing, that's a misdemeanor.
And again, under the new misconduct rules, that could prevent you from being a cop again. It also requires police departments to share complete employment records of their officers with other agencies. That was something that police leaders came to the General Assembly and said, this needs to be improved, because a lot of times, let's say we're trying to hire a new officer, we have this applicant, we ask their previous department, hey, you know, what can you tell us about them? And the only answer you get is, yeah, well, they worked for us. And they'd get no other information. And the whole point here is we don't want bad cops to be bouncing around from agency and agency to agency. So there's a lot in that bill. And it not only had bipartisan support, it passed the House unanimously. It has support of the Indiana Black Legislative Caucus, the NAACP, other key Black organizations, as well as the Indiana Public Defenders Council, the Indiana Prosecuting Attorneys Council, and every major law enforcement organization in the state of Indiana.
It's got a lot of support.
To get all of those groups to say yes to this piece of legislation is a towering achievement I didn't think was possible. And it is a great credit to Greg Stuart-Wald, who's been a leader on criminal justice reform for a long time in the General Assembly. But this could be, you know, I was talking with him recently, and he said, like, this could be the really big one. So we'll see if that gets through the second half of session. It's now in the Senate unscathed. That's a big key for Representative Stuart-Wald and the group supporting this. They don't want changes. They like this package, and we'll see if the Senate sticks to that. But if it does, that could be a real star on top of the tree of 2021.
All right. Well, looking forward just a bit, what are you watching most closely right now for the rest of the session, Nikki?
Oh, well, obviously the budget, you know, it's a two-year, $36 billion budget, so it impacts virtually every part of life in Indiana, so that's a key one. governor powers for emergencies, you know, a little bit of everything. Obviously, school funding's a big deal, too.
Mm-hmm. Brandon, same question for you. What are some of the most interesting things that you think people should keep an eye out in the second half of this session that's coming up?
Yeah, one thing I'll add to Nikki's list, obviously everything Nikki just said I'm also watching for, but the governor had set up a couple years ago a two-year teacher compensation commission to look at the issue of teacher pay in Indiana. We know Hoosier teachers are underpaid compared to their peers across the country. And he set up this big commission to look at the issue and develop recommendations. And they did. They released those recommendations at the end of last year. There's a lot of them across the board, things that teachers can do, things that local schools can do, things that the state legislature can do. And to this point in the session, not a single recommendation for the legislature has been acted on. Not one. There's nothing that Republicans in the General Assembly have done to help teachers get paid more money.
Why is that?
You've got, I honestly don't know. We have asked Republican leaders that question multiple times now, and I don't know that we've gotten an answer beyond, well, we're increasing education funding. Well, as Nikki talked about earlier, if the funding increase you're giving to K-12 public education doesn't even keep up with inflation after you take voucher dollars out of it, I'm not sure how you can call that something for teacher pay. They're going to try, certainly, but the thing I'm interested in watching is if they do anything out of this governor's commission recommendations to try and at least give a head fake towards teachers that, well, we care a little bit about what you're paid.
Any legislators come out in big support of it?
I mean, certainly Democrats have been calling for teacher pay increases for a long time, and there haven't been a lot of Republicans who've been behind that, but there are some Republicans who are more on the side of let's give teachers more money and find concrete ways to do that as opposed to just building it into our overall education budget. But we haven't seen much of that this session from Republicans, certainly.
Yeah. Anything else coming up in the next week or so that you're going to keep a specific eye out on?
Not soon, because lawmakers usually like to start the second half of their session a little slow. We'll see if they try to do anything big here early on. But they usually take a little bit to get back going after they come out of the halftime break.
The halftime break. Intermission. What about you, exactly. Nikki? You have anything you're working on coming up?
You know, I mean, just a few things. There are a few interesting election bills moving that are sort of related to what we saw last year. One of them limits only the legislature would be able to make any changes to elections. Last year, the governor and the election commission delayed the primary and allowed people to vote absentee by mail. That would halt that in the future. There are some smaller changes on absentee ballots that they're adding. So those are definitely something to watch as well.
All right. Sounds good. Well, thank you both so much for all your work and taking time to give us an update on what's going on at the State House. Today, talking to Brandon Smith, State House reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting, and Nikki Kelly, government and politics reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason, and Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of the show or any past show, you can find it anywhere that you get your podcast. I'm Taylor Bennett. Thanks so much for listening today. This is All In.